Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. We've got another really interesting guest for you today. We have Dana Weiser. She is an assistant professor in human development and family studies and an affiliate faculty member in women's studies at Texas Tech University. Welcome, Dana.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the easy question. Tell us a little bit about what an assistant professor in human development and family studies does. What kind of classes do you teach? What is your research? What do you look into?
Well, I teach human sexuality. Right now this semester, I'm teaching it at the undergraduate as well as the graduate level. And then most of my research looks at how family experiences are related to individuals' own romantic relationships and sexuality.
So what does that mean? Like, what? Give me an example of a particular study that you're working on.
So my main line of research is I look at family patterns of infidelity. So how the experience of a parent cheating is related to their young adult child's now likelihood of having engaged in infidelity. What I find is that there's a very consistent and very strong relationship between the two, so that individuals who have knowledge that their parent engaged in infidelity are about twice as likely to have engaged in infidelity compared to their peers who are saying that they're, you know, to the best of their knowledge, neither of their parents have engaged in infidelity.
No, so have you noticed that those patterns of infidelity, is that due mostly to the environment then, you think, or is it partly due to genetics or some combination of the two?
I think it's due to some combination of the two. There's been some really interesting work looking at genetic influences for family patterns of divorce. So the intergenerational transmission of divorce is one of the more well-known phenomenons in the social sciences, so that someone whose parents divorce are significantly more at risk to divorce themselves. And so I've kind of used this body of work to extrapolate on my own research. And so the divorce literature finds that it's a lot of social influences. So individuals whose parents divorced are a little less committed to their relationships. They have more positive attitudes towards divorce, possibly because they saw their parents have maybe a bad marriage and got out of it and were really happy afterwards. So they don't view divorce as disastrous as people who might not have had that experience. But there's been also some really interesting work looking at genetic influences, and they do find that at least some of that relationship is due to genetics. Not all of it, but there's at least some small part of the puzzle that is genetics, because people, there have been particular genes that look at impulse control, how people react to conflict. There's been some research looking at hormones, and so that people who produce higher levels of testosterone, men who produce higher levels of testosterone are more likely to engage in infidelity. So there's definitely some bio components to it.
But you can't really isolate one thing from the other.
No, I mean, you can if you did some really awesome twin studies. So if I, which, and they have. So actually, some of the other countries like Australia and New Zealand keep track of their twins. They're twins, like, so they all get documented and registered. And so they've actually done really cool studies, like tracking their relationships, and not only their relationships, but their children's relationships. And so they can look at what happens if one twin divorces to their children, so that you can tell a little bit where that genetic influence is. But social explanations appear to be a bit more powerful.
How did you get into this field in general? I mean, why is infidelity a topic that you like spending time looking into, and what led you to it?
I think it's just absolutely fascinating that when you ask people, should you, like, is cheating bad? Should you be faithful to your partner? Everyone absolutely always says, of course, you're faithful, you're monogamous. You know, very few people say that infidelity is a good thing, yet they cheat. So what's going on? There's that paradox. And so one of the ways that I found in my work is that most people say it's bad, but there are people who think it's less bad, so that there are certain circumstances that justify it. So that's why I think it's just so interesting, because it's something that pretty much everyone has a story that either they were cheated on or some family member or friend was cheated on. So it's really something that's a common experience, but
everyone's in denial.
Everyone's in denial.
They have their own, like, of course I'd never do that, but.
Of course I would never do that, but. And then it's very funny, is there are survey instruments where you go, so if there's zero risk of you getting caught, how likely are you to have sex with someone else? And they'll be like, okay, if there's zero risk.
Funny how that works.
Yes. Obviously, it's survey versus behavior. So even if they say that they think that they would do it, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would, but it's interesting.
So is monogamy then something that is, I don't know, artificially created in our society? Like, is it, are we just sort of fighting a battle that can't be won?
Yeah, no, and you're asking actually one of the big questions right now in relationship science, because there's a lot of research that shows that infidelity occurs. So kind of the higher ends is for individuals who are married, about a quarter of marriages will have some type of infidelity. And we can see that less than half of marriages end in divorce. We've seen the divorce rate decline in recent years, and it's held pretty steady for the last 30 years. So this idea of a lifetime partnership exists to a certain degree, but it doesn't necessarily work for everyone. And it might not work for everyone at certain points in time as well. So it's a huge question to ask. Is monogamy just a really sweet social idea that we have, or is it functional? And there's some research that argues that monogamy is functional. It helps people raise children. There's a lot of research showing that when you're in committed romantic relationships, you have more satisfying sex, probably because you can communicate better, you trust your partner more, you can kind of let go and relax. And also there's appears to be quite a bit of a health benefit to being in a romantic relationship. So people are less depressed, they're less likely to have substance abuse problems. Now obviously some of this is interactional, so that I'm not drinking because I have an awesome relationship and my awesome relationship helps me not to drink. But when we look at longitudinal relationships, there is protective factor of being with a partner. And I don't think it necessarily needs to be marriage per se, but we know that committed romantic relationships at least have positive functions. Now the question is it realistic to have that be for your entire life?
That's interesting. I mean, I've heard several discussions about biology, you know, evolutionarily, like, okay, it helped you if you paired off with someone who could, you know, provide X, Y, and Z, and you could provide the opposite, if mm-hmm. you're talking like, you know, protecting you from the saber-toothed tigers as you were, you know, gathering berries, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're, like, there, it makes sense to not go it alone, but I guess the idea that we as this, like, modern society assume that having a partner to keep you alive also includes sex and also includes all these other things is just our default assumption now, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, kids are really expensive, so the evolutionary people will call it parental investment. So in hunter-gatherer times, your parental investment would be providing safety, providing shelter, providing food, providing good genes. And
it's easier to do that with two people.
It's easier to do that with two people, and it's certainly easier to do with two people now. But one of the things that we're seeing in social science research right now is because the lifespan has expanded so much from that time, that a lot of these expectations of partnering and partnership aren't necessarily realistic. Because if, you know, if I have a child today, when they're getting ready to graduate college, I would still be in my early 50s, which to us is, you know, you'd be like, I'm young, I'm in my early 50s. And you could be like, I still have, you know, 35 good years of my life left to live. Do I want to keep doing this with this person?
That's a whole other emptiness syndrome question.
Yeah, and we see that actually there's an increase in individuals over the age of 65 who are getting divorced right now. They're called either gray divorces or silver divorces.
Oh, yeah. How nice.
Yeah. So I'll tell my students the example of like Al and Tipper Gore, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. Because to me, I have that like very vivid image. Like, do you remember in the 2000 election when they were like making out on stage?
Oh, right? That kiss. Yeah. Oh, that was so, I'm still cringing.
I know. But and then they get divorced. So what's going on there? And of course, then this is a perfect example of how my cultural references do not match.
Oh, Mumu has those all the time.
Oh, I asked my students if they knew who the Clash were, and there were maybe 5 of them who did.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Did you play some Clash for them? Like, were you like, okay, we're going to rock the Casbah now?
No, I told them to go home and play it on YouTube, and I don't think they did. They just kind of were like, okay, sure, it's some band. Doesn't matter.
So here's a sort of current events question for you, Dina.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a whole lot of discussion. I mean, there's always discussion, but it feels like it's more prevalent now about like ingrained sexism in society, public incidences of sexism and violence related to sexism, whether you talk about domestic violence and that kind of stuff. Do you think things have changed? Are we talking about it more, or is it just we're in a like a bubble and it's up right now, but next week it'll be down and it's not really anything new?
I think we're talking about it a lot more, and I think that it's going to be part of our common vocabulary until we start seeing some changes. So when we look at the statistics of things like intimate partner violence and sexual assault, it's really good in the United States that a lot of these rates have dropped significantly over the last 20 and 30 years. What is very concerning when we particularly look at the sexual assault research, though, is that reporting has dropped considerably. And so one of the major explanations behind that is that a lot of the system has inherent sexism. So it's not just an issue of questioning gender dynamics about why these really terrible, awful things happen to people, but also then what can we do to prevent them from happening in the future? And reporting is a major component of that. And understanding how to make the system safer for people who have been victimized, I think, is a major question for both sexes who are very much invested in having a safe environment for people. I think that also a lot of information about these relationships is becoming much more common so that people don't have the same stereotypes that they used to.
Are the stories that come out, for instance, from the NFL about the sort of domestic assaults that happen, does that help or hurt the cause?
I think it helps because it starts being – it becomes less isolating because it's a huge problem, obviously, in NFL culture that in probably most professional sports that we have – you know, men who are essentially socialized to be really aggressive. That's what they're paid to do, is to get as strong as possible, to get angry, to, you know, have these huge bursts where they, you know, do their job. And it's problematic. But I think it also highlights the fact that these issues happen regardless of race, regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of professional. So I think anytime a spotlight can be shed on an issue, the hope we can have that we can actually have a meaningful dialogue and conversation about it.
What was your reaction when the whole Ray Rice thing sort of exploded? Were you sitting there going, oh, here we go again, or let's hope this changes things?
I think anytime there's an incident, I hope we can change things. I just remember being so disgusted. And it's this very fortunate life experience that I know about these issues so well, but I've never had to experience them firsthand. And so to actually have these videos of him just punching his wife, well, his fiance at the time, in the face, I think is something that's really jarring and I think really struck a chord with people. And I think that it's become clear to the NFL that they really can't have another incident like this. And we can see that for subsequent domestic violence cases, at least it's a conversation that's happening. I think Ray Rice is probably the most famous of football players who this has happened to. And I think also that video is one of the reasons why it was so jarring, because you could actually see it happening. And I think it also is very valuable. I know that's very odd to say, but it really highlights that when we look at who's committing violence against women, because although certainly men can be abused and can be raped, the numbers are overwhelmingly that it's women. And it's also mainly women who are it's their partner. So it's someone that they know, they might love, they trust, that is often committing this abuse, including sexual assault. And that's something that is not common knowledge that we talk a lot about. So when we talk about rape prevention, we usually do stranger danger, you know, don't walk around at night alone, make sure you carry your mace. And realistically, that might help you not get robbed, but it doesn't stop sexual assault, because it's very rare that it's a stranger. It does happen. And so I'm not saying, you know, just run around, be fancy free, but it sheds light that this is an issue of relationships. It's an issue of gender dynamics. It's not an issue of that one psycho who is, you know, waiting in your car. It's pervasively an intermingling of love and violence that we see these things happen.
What was your opinion about the UVA story that came out recently?
The UVA story is obviously difficult because we, for the specific narrative, don't necessarily know what is fact or what is fiction. But what we do know is that it struck a chord with so many women. So whether that is a fictionalized account or not, it's probably a narrative that hundreds of women across the United States have had the experience of having. And I think that how the fallout was dealt with is really problematic, because it really is discouraging reporting. You know, I can think of no other crime where so much is on the victim to prove that their actions, like, it wasn't their fault that something happened. So, like, if my house got burglarized or something was stolen out of my car, the police officer isn't going to go, like, so what were you wearing? You know, did you have your blinds open? Did you remember to lock your door? Like, there's assumptions that I'm protecting my home in a way that we don't treat women with the same assumptions that they're doing that. And so when we look at people pick apart these one particular story and ignore the fact that there are going to be hundreds of cases of rape that aren't being reported, because a lot of times we have this culture, and we call it rape culture, where women know that they are going to be treated so poorly by their peers, by the popular media, if they go forward and try and seek justice because a crime was committed against them. So it's something like 30% of all rapes are reported in the United States, and the numbers are actually lower for college students.
What can we as a society do? Is there something that can be done, or do we just need to keep these conversations going?
I think that it's definitely keeping the conversation alive. I think also it's breaking down a lot of rape myths that we have. So a lot of people have this idea that, you know, all rape is the stranger on the street, which we've addressed is not the case, or they'll hold up miscommunication. So we obviously have these very unfortunate cases where guy and girl are out drinking, they flirt, they go back. The next day, the woman's like, I was not in my right mind. And then that happens. And any conversation I ever have, someone goes, well, what about that case? And I go, that really sucks. And that's a really tough question. I have an answer of how we can deal with that. But I'm much more concerned about these 6% of individuals who actively prey upon women. Like, when we look at who these people are, they will admit openly that they're using very aggressive, deceptive tactics to get women in bed, including using date rape drugs, including making sure that they are very purposely that drunk. And I think that's the biggest concern, is looking out for those guys, understanding who they are. If you're a man, making sure that you're not friends with that guy and tell him that you think his behavior is not okay. If you are a woman, being on the lookout for that behavior. And also just keeping an eye out for one another, of seeing, like, if someone's being really aggressive with your friend, or if they've had maybe too much to drink and they're hanging out with someone. Sometimes it takes saying, like, I don't get a good vibe from this person. Maybe you should just exchange numbers and you can worry about it. And what happens is these guys know that if they aren't getting that person alone that night, they aren't getting laid. And so there'll be this kind of isolation of going on. As far as the miscommunication part, which is rarer for sexual assault, I think a lot of what it has to do is just education about sex. I think that we in the U.S. have a culture where we are not comfortable talking about sex, and we particularly socialize women that they are not comfortable talking about sex and what they want and what they don't want. And when we look at how women consent, a lot of times it is nonverbal. Now, you know, 99% of the time they do mean to consent, but why aren't we teaching women to be like, yes, I want to have sex with you. I think you are hotter than Jake Gyllenhaal. Rip my clothes off and let's make love. Like, you know, I feel like if we could socialize us so much better to have, like, these positive components of sexuality, we can take so much miscommunication out of sex, because people feel guilty, they feel embarrassed, they feel uncomfortable, and that's just a perfect storm. So if we're actually just saying, like, hey, you know, 16-year-old girl, it's you, if you want to have sex, go have sex, as long as it's with someone you know, you trust, you use a condom, you're making the choice because you want to get laid and not because you're being coerced, not because you feel like you have to, not because the media or your friends tell you. Like, who cares?
Actually, you bring up an interesting point. You know, our focus of our conversation has mostly been about what's been going on in the U.S. And so do you see differences in either the number of occurrences or the way that other countries treat domestic violence or sexual abuse? So, for instance, France is, you know, we know that country or the culture is a little bit more open about sexuality and sort of all these things. Do we not see the same types of problems there that we see here?
I mean, we see a sexual assault in every single culture. That's certainly true. But when we look at cultures that have greater comfort with sexuality and also have greater levels of gender equality, which is a big part in there, we see much more diminished rates of these issues. And there's a pretty direct relationship. as far as gender equality and also a lot of just sexism. So we do a lot of, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, women just want this, like women want this from men. Men only want to get laid. And what that's doing is creating distrust between the genders, which is something that we see cross-culturally as well, that it's called kind of hostile sexism, that you don't trust men or women. It works both ways. So women can view men as not good people either. But when we look at, you know, this level of sexism is directly related to these issues. And you can imagine that cultures where there's greater levels of gender inequality, there's a lot greater sexism. The more comfortable we are with sex in general, we can start to diminish problematic sex. And I think that education plays a huge key. And the sex education in the United States is very, very limited.
If at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so where I teach is an abstinence-only school district, and there's a lot of variability in Texas. So some people have had very comprehensive good sex education. Others are super uncomfortable with sex, and even though they're, a lot of them are having sex, they really haven't ever learned.
Talked about it.
Yeah, they haven't learned about it or talked about it, and I think that having that education not only empowers you to have safer sex, but also more satisfying sex. They actually know what their bodies are doing and what the body parts are that are linked to their body.
Wait. Basic anatomy? I don't understand.
Yeah. No, it's shocking. I mean, it's rare, but one of the graduate students who's teaching human sexuality said that she actually had a student who was a mother who did not realize where babies came out of, still.
Oh, yeah. You mean is it like the congressman in where was it, Idaho?
Yes,
who was like, you can just swallow a camera for your annual exam.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So they, I think having these basic anatomy biology is really important, and the more we can do to have people be in tune with their bodies, understanding that sex is a perfectly normal part of life. And even if your morals are that you aren't planning on having sex until you're married, don't you still want to have good, hot sex?
Well, and know the biology of said procreation, if that's your thing.
Yeah, and even if you're getting, you know, you're not having sex until you're married, get married, you know, 23, 25, you still got quite a number of years where you have to worry about contraception. And to bring it all around to my own work about infidelity, just because you're married doesn't mean you're protected against other things.
Ah, very nicely done, Dana. Yes. Excellent work.
I am such a romantic, let me tell you.
So this is my last question. And it's not about sex, unfortunately.
Oh.
I know, I'm sorry. Here's the question. What this sort of podcast has been is talking to people who do science and technology and engineering and math and sort of entrepreneur stuff. A lot of people, I am not one of them, would argue that social scientists are like soft science. Okay, what's in your, and I know you're probably like fuming.
No.
what's your argument for why social sciences, psychology, human biology, human development is as important as some other science?
It's just as important because we can speak a lot to your everyday life and the decisions that you make as far as your relationships, parenting. I mean, we've touched on some very serious issues in a matter of moments of sexual assault, satisfying relationships, healthy sex lives. These are all things that are informed by social science, and having that understanding of how I'm actually interacting in my everyday environment is meaningful, and it is completely related to then how I am medically experiencing my life. So people who are in a satisfying romantic relationship have fewer health problems. So it's all integrated of knowing what's going on with my life, my social experiences is going to then be integrated with my health, my mental health, my well-being. And so I think that this dichotomy of hard sciences versus social sciences is really arbitrary because they inform one another. And I think we're especially seeing a trend where we're becoming integrated because we see how important it is to work one with one another. I mean, even with one of the newer branches of psychology is human factors, and it's essentially how people interact with their environment and to optimize performance, to optimize well-being. You can imagine someone in human factors working with someone in engineering or architecture of how to like optimally design something that people are productive and learning and doing well at their jobs, things like that. So I think social sciences are absolutely essential. And I look at some of the research that my peers do of AIDS prevention or early childhood education to reducing crime at the corporate level. These are all things that are so important.
Well, and speaking of hard scientists, science, one of our other guests that we spoke to is a virologist, and she's studying one tiny little part of the herpes vaccine, mm-hmm. herpes virus, and coming up with a possible vaccine, all these other things. So here we are talking about sex education and you know, those kind of elements in everyone's daily life. And yet, at the same time, there's somebody on the other side, in the biology side, working on one little protein receptor of the herpes virus. I mean, it is all connected, right?
And we have actually have a lot of research that's ongoing with where a lot of engineers are trying to figure out human behavior as well. We're trying to model, you know, pilots' behavior or how people are going to react within, you know, the system that we design. So we're actually reaching out more and more to psychologists or to people who are studying, you know, behavioral sciences to try to figure that out as well, because we have no idea.
This is Mumu's ploy to get robots into the conversation and drones into the conversation.
I'm trying to do that for every single episode. Here we go.
Because really, you need the psychology when you send the hotel robot to somebody's door to knock on the door.
I had a friend who recently was staying at a hotel and she had a little robot deliver her toothbrush. She was so a psychologist. Cute.
I love it.
We come full circle.
And we got robots into the conversation. Woohoo!
Well, and I think it really is important to think about how to integrate this all together. And I think that dismantling a lot of funding for social sciences is really dangerous. So two of my collaborators are in the Department of Pediatrics at the Med School for Texas Tech, which is Texas Tech Health Sciences Center. And they do research on HPV, and we know we have a very effective vaccine against HPV, but people aren't getting it. And the way to explain why some people are starting the vaccine, why people are getting all three dosages or not, is going to be through social sciences. So we could have the cure to cancer, and if we can't communicate with people or understand why people are, you know, adhering to treatment or seeking out treatment, it's not going to do any good.
Interesting. Really interesting. Well, Dana, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy teaching schedule to talk to us about all these things. It's really interesting. So it's been really fun talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to, can we have a drone or a robot that cuts out people texting in class or something?
I don't know, Mumu, that's on your
plate. I'll
on
work on a jammer for you.
Okay.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.